Hello and welcome to Series 6, Episode 7 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Hello. I hope that whenever you're listening to this, you're having a good week or day or maybe even just a good hour. I have a very croaky voice today. I've got that cold that's going round, that cold that's not COVID that's going round. So I sound a little bit like I'm doing a late night radio drive-in show. Which? Drive-in show? Call-in show. A late drive show. You know what I mean. One of those shows that happen late at night. Anyway, let's carry on. Let's carry on with what we're already here for. We're here for an episode of Out. I've got a fantastic guest today. It's Heather Peace, who you'll definitely be aware of. She's currently in EastEnders, but she's also been in Lip Service and London's Burning and loads of other TV. And she's brilliant. And I was very excited to talk to her. We recorded in a little studio in Brighton, because that's where we both live, which is very exciting to wander down to a little studio and make friends with the technician. And we had a really brilliant chat, and I'm really excited to share that with you. But before that, I've got a couple of emails to share. Two quite long ones this week, but I thought they were both brilliant and worth sharing. So let's have a listen. Hi, Susie. I hope you're well and enjoying life in your new house. I love hearing all your updates and latest news on your moves. At least you're not having to broadcast from under a duvet this week. I'm not actually. Thanks for saying that. I'm in my little office space, which is very exciting. I write this to you as a very close ally, and you feel like my friend now, which I've heard many people say to you now. And after listening to all of your Out and Like-Minded Friends podcasts, I even got my husband and my closest gay best friends to listen. Myself and my husband came to see you in Islington in the summer and are coming to see you next year at the Soho Theatre. We can't wait. Oh, thanks so much. Always stick around and say hi. You know how much I love meeting the listeners of Out and Like-Minded Friends. Anyway, enough of the intros. Every week, I mean to write to you following listening to one of the episodes of Out or Like-Minded Friends. You hiring a guy to put together your IKEA furniture got me to do it. I also hired someone to do this. Life is far too short. And I laughed out loud when Tom was incredulous at this. It's true. I admitted it on Like-Minded Friends. I'm so rubbish at putting furniture together. And it really upsets me because I feel like as a lesbian who does have a tool bag, I should be able to do this, but I'm just absolutely shit at it. However, this week you've prompted me to write while I'm listening to your Out episode with Darren Styles. I'm actually just in the middle of hearing your correspondence part, and I simply had to take my headphones out, lift up my laptop lid and write to you. And why have I done this? For weeks now, I've wanted to write in about difference and about people being excluded who have some type of neurodiverse challenge. My daughter was diagnosed with ADHD and OCD last year, and now recently with ASD, autism. She's felt very different for a long time. Friends, family, and school people have struggled to understand and include someone who is very different to them. This is not the same as having to deal with one's sexuality, but it is relevant in finding a place in society and work. Hence why I thought it would be relevant to you in your podcast. You just spoke about thinking you might have ADHD as well as your dyslexia. Well, get this. I took one of my daughter's ADHD tablets today to try one out, as I believe I might have ADHD after understanding a little more about it and how it shows up in her. I've been thinking about it for a while, and during this busy period and the lead up to Christmas, I was starting to feel pressured and overwhelmed. Normally, I would think about doing something for weeks before I finally take action, but no. Today, I just sat down and got straight on with writing this message to you. And maybe I could have gotten a lot more work done without fannying around like I normally do. Maybe I'll even get round to booking the dentist tomorrow if I take another tablet. Lol. So there we go. And now I'm going to try and get a diagnosis at age 55. I wanted to share this with you and your listeners, and also to let you know how much joy and understanding you bring to people's lives. You're absolutely doing stellar work for your community, and I think you're amazing. I understand so much more now about the different parts of the community and the challenges that people have been through and continue to go through. I've especially loved the episodes with Jordan Gray, Self-Esteem, Steph McGovern and Adam Kay, people I hadn't heard of. And I haven't stopped listening to Self-Esteem's new album since. And of course, some of the old faves too, like Duncan James, Scott Mills, Gok Wan, and of course, Tom Allen. We all shed a tear. Also, to let you know, I actually found your podcast by listening to Alan Carr's Life's a Beach, and it suggested that I listen to you. So thank you to the Spotify algorithm for opening up new things. Anyway, enough of me. Thanks again for all of your work and your fab humour. There's always a laugh to be had around you, in my opinion. And I would have stood up on the train after Pride in Brighton, after what those horrible blokes did to you. Okay, I'm off to continue listening to this week's episode. Take care, and by a slim chance, if you read this out, I'm happy for you to share my name, Rachel. Rachel, thank you so much for getting in touch. The first thing I'm going to say, in case any doctors are listening, I don't recommend that people take other people's tablets just before I get anyone complaining to me, but I am so pleased that you are finding a sense of community through this podcast, even though you might not fit in. Obviously, you're an ally, so you're part of the community. But I think you're absolutely right. When we're talking about people finding their place, I think anything that comes under other, and I use that word in a very positive sense, to be clear. I've always considered myself to be other, and I quite like other. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think the more that we can find those links across society where we are different, but we have so many similarities, and by being slightly outside of, I don't know, whatever the other opposite is, I don't really want to say norm, but you know what I mean. Maybe that's a great way that we should all think about things. I hope that your daughter's doing okay. That sounds like a lot to deal with for a young person. And I'm sending you and her lots of love. I mean, she sounds like she's got a bloody brilliant mum, so thank God she's got you. And thank you so much for getting in touch. And stick around after the show when you come to the Soho show. I'd love to say hi. Okay, let's have another one. Susie, hello. Firstly, thank you. Out is an incredible podcast and has helped me so much over the past year. You've created something beautiful, and I hope you know it. I've learned so much, particularly from non-binary and trans guests and listeners that have related so much in so many stories from all across the LGBTQIA+ community. The diversity of your podcast is so important because it feels like a space where people are free to share their own full truth without necessarily having to represent everyone who shares a letter with them. Sorry in advance what I know will end up being a massive letter. I feel a little starstruck to be writing in and really can't wrap my head around the fact that anyone might read this. I'm reading it right now, whilst at the same time I feel like I know you. I guess we've been having very interesting conversations for months. I've just kept my mouth shut until now. Well, here we are. Congratulations on your new home, Brighton. Sounds fantastic, and I wish you all the best for your life there. I first came across Out in the summer of 2019, and I'm sad to say I didn't listen at the time. I was 22, and I'd never been in a relationship, except for a very short thing when I was 16. I'd never had sex, and I wasn't really bothered about that. And I was, I assumed, straight. I'd probably know by now, right? If I wasn't? I'd gone on a few different dates with one guy at uni and bailed as soon as the conversation ran out. I thought I was just shy or awkward and that I'd meet someone eventually, whilst also beginning to suspect there might be something more going on than I was letting on. And so Out intrigued me. I would bring it up on Spotify, hover over the play, and then close it. I knew in my head there was no harm to listen, but I think I was unsure. Someone might see or read something into it, and I wasn't sure how I felt. I just didn't know. I was recently bereaved, and I suspect that I knew that Out was the key to a box I wasn't ready to open. My childhood friend had died suddenly at 24. Grief is a bit too much to get into here, but part of it for me was an overwhelming awareness of my own mortality. Until then, I hadn't been particularly worried about my lack of a partner or sexuality. I assumed I had a lifetime to figure it all out, to find someone, to fall in love, to have kids, to live the life I'd been promised by society and culture and films and the slightly cringy young adult novels I'd lapped up as a teenage bookworm. We all get a lifetime, but you never know how long that lifetime might be. Some of us get lucky. For some of us, one day is a real place that we'll visit. Some of us don't. I grew worried that I wasn't really living. I was just waiting passively while life happened around me. Not true in most areas, but definitely true regarding relationships. One of the things that scared me most was that I might die before I had the chance to fall in love. I had love already in my life, good friends, amazing family, but I also wanted to experience the love of a partner, and one day maybe how it felt to love as a parent. All the different kinds of love. I'm a greedy little love goblin. I always felt that I would find it hard to trust someone in that way, that it would take me a long time, require them making all the first moves. Even then, the process would require so much from me. I'd only been able to do it once. I was waiting for somebody to sweep me off my feet like a character in a novel and that we would live happily ever after. Bizarrely, that's exactly what happened. Well, at least the sweeping part. I met a guy at the start of March 2020, immediately before the pandemic. He made a grand romantic gesture and told me that he liked me. I said yes in my head to everything that followed. Say yes, give it a shot. See where this goes. Be brave. You might die tomorrow. Because this was in the midst of a pandemic, and giving it a shot ended up meaning as soon as travel restrictions eased, we moved in together immediately into a tiny caravan away from all my family and friends. Now, seeing that I'm writing, it could have gone so much worse than it did. But even so, it was quite an intense experience. It's not one that I regret because I learned a lot about myself, but I also realised very quickly that this was still not it. The first time we kissed, I cried. I was still somehow missing that mystical, invisible force that dragged people together. I was open from the beginning that I had previously thought in passing that I might be asexual, but still wanted to give things a shot. He was very understanding and had been in relationships with queer people before, so we took things slow. If that's not a stupid thing to say when you've gone from single to sharing a bed and a home and a life with someone overnight. I stayed in that relationship until the end, which was just over a year and a half later. Not having sex became an issue, so I had sex, which sounds a lot simpler written down than it does in reality. I told myself that I was in love despite knowing that I was still feeling things differently from how other people described that experience. I felt like this might be as close as I could ever get, so I continued to say yes in my head, past the point of where, if I had been able to be honest with myself, I would have said no. I felt like an alien, lacking in some fundamental human quality that everybody else had. I felt like there was something broken about me. The parts of the relationship were good enough to cling on to, perhaps because they were more than I had before. I became desperate not to lose him, and in all honesty, desperate to be loved. I struggled with the feeling that I wasn't being myself somehow, or like I was lying. After a while, his feelings changed. I'd known that was a possibility. Heartbreak, understandably, gets a lot of airtime in our culture. But it was still a shock to the alien, goblin, small woodland creature living in my head, trying to figure out how humans work. They'd done everything they were supposed to do, and yet here I was, angry, hurt, hollowed out, like I'd stretched myself out of shape to fit around somebody else's needs. I tried very, very hard to be straight. I'm not. I don't know exactly who I am. Don't expect to ever, to be honest. But I suspect at the moment, age 26, I'm a hopelessly romantic, queer, asexual woman. I also have a pretty good feeling that, even though I'm near the start of this journey, I have a full and complicated human sexuality that just doesn't happen to be orientated around anyone else. Listening to Out has really helped me understand and accept this about myself, and I can't thank you enough, and all your guests and the listeners. I've related to so many stories on the podcast, but perhaps unexpectedly for me, especially to those about gay women and lesbians, maybe even more so than to asexual and aromantic listeners, even though that representation and Jasmine's episode meant so much to me. I think this is because I've shared the experience and the internalised phobia. For a lot of your guests, that's internalised homophobia, but for me, I guess you could call it internalised ace phobia. I didn't try so hard to be straight because I was afraid I might be gay. I was afraid I might be something else entirely. This feels bad to admit, but there were plenty of times I thought, I hoped, maybe I'm just gay. I know there's no just about it, and I don't want to compare experiences. I don't believe that being gay would be easier. I just think because, thanks to amazing progress that's been won, I already knew that it was possible to be gay and happy and in love. Most of my friends are gay or bi, shock. I knew that you could be gay and fall in love and maybe one day, with a lot of effort, have a child. But being asexual and wanting a romantic relationship felt like a sentence to a loveless life with no possibility of family. The same fear that many of your guests or their parents have talked about time and time again. Now, though, I have to hope that one day I might meet someone who I can be myself with and build a life with, who won't mind that I'm not sexually attracted to them. I suspect that person won't be a man, but who knows? The space you've created and worked so hard to make inclusive has given me somewhere to realise that even if I don't find that mythical person, my life won't be any less full because of it. By giving a platform to so many different voices under the queer umbrella in the same shared space, you've allowed me to piece together something which might have been much harder to do if those stories were cordoned off from each other. Listening to experiences of gay women, I might not fully see myself respected. No passionate crushes here or teenage sexual turmoil to go through, although definitely some intense female friendship and comfy shoes. Equally, it's hard to find stories from the asexual experience, which exists mostly on forums. Whilst I'm sure the internet forums can be incredible and probably do host positive stories, they're not a space I naturally feel comfortable or myself. They feel like a corner of the internet where it's easy to drown if you're not in a good place to start with. Despite the joy and community I'm sure exists, I was drawn to two narratives. People who, like a few of the listeners who've contributed to Out, didn't want romantic relationships and were perfectly content with that. Amazing, valid, brilliant to be exposed to, but felt very far from my experiences. or those who were trying desperately, as I had been, to make a relationship work with someone of a differing sexuality, which is very difficult. On Out, hearing the experiences of gay and asexual women in the same space allowed me to build a mirror for myself from different fragments, to seeing myself as not broken or an alien, just human. I could join the dots between different experiences, whether that was my internalized fear and the damage it was doing, or the knowledge that being single is genuinely a complete and valid way to live, and it doesn't have to come at the cost of your happiness, self-worth, or love. You've allowed me to imagine a future where I might end up with somebody, but maybe I don't, and either way I could be happy. You've also helped me understand that wanting to be a parent one day doesn't have to be dictated by my sexuality, and that it's still possible as a single person with incredible family and friends. Basically, my queerness might look different from other people's, but that doesn't mean it isn't real, or that I can't still find joy and live a full life of love. Thank you for holding all my mirrors. Love, Josie. If you read this out and it's not too long, you're welcome to use my name. Well, Josie, what a lovely email to receive. I've got someone lined up for the next series who is also asexual. As you can imagine, I try and record quite a few in advance when I'm not too busy, but there's someone that was suggested to me a little while ago, so I have got in touch with them. So many of the stories in our society are all about falling in love and meeting that special person. And I think you're totally right. If that's not what feels right for you, that doesn't mean that your life is any less. It doesn't mean that, you know, that you're missing out on anything if it's something that you're not seeking. And you're absolutely right. Everyone can become a parent somehow this day, whether you're looking at IVF, IUI, surrogacy, adoption. There are so many ways to become a parent. And that's definitely something that you can hope for and look forward to in your future. I'm so pleased that this podcast has been something that you've felt connected to and something that you've enjoyed, and that, you know, when I receive emails like that, it reminds me that the hours I spend making it are really, really worthwhile. And I really appreciate you getting in touch. Please do email me. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. As ever, I'm always keen to hear from you. But let's go to today's conversation with the brilliant Heather Peace. Heather Peace is an English actress and musician. You will know her from London's Burning, Waterloo Road, Lip Service, This England, and most recently, she joined the cast of EastEnders, one of Britain's most loved soaps. My mum's absolute favourite, in fact, so she's very excited that I'm talking to Heather today. An impressive musician as well, with a brilliant voice, she has toured extensively with her music and released several albums. Heather is also a big voice in our community. She is patron of Manchester Pride and works with many charities to promote LGBTQIA+ equality, including Stonewall, Diversity Role Models and AKT. On a personal note, when I first met Heather nearly 10 years ago, we did a mini tour of music and comedy with Jen Brister and Zoe Lyons. And just being around someone who was clearly so comfortable in their own skin and with their sexuality had a hugely positive impact on me. Acting, music, activism, a wife and three children under eight. I am amazed that she's managed to find time to come and talk to me today. But thank you very much for coming in. Hello, Heather.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Are you very tired?
Today I am a little bit tired, but I'm juggling a few balls at the moment. And Ellie woke me up at 3 o'clock. I think I was just telling you on the way in. She's a last minute stand-in to go to Belgium and back in a day.
Because she's a school teacher.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, she's not buying chocolates.
I must go.
She's got up at 3 o'clock. They set off on a coach at 3:30. I think I last messaged her at about 8, and she did say she was in hell. She'd taken a pillow to have a little sleep on the coach, and I think she found herself by the rowdiest students. So I don't know whether she's made it to Belgium yet, and she's not back till 10:30 tonight. So yeah,
wow.
I sort of woke up with her, and then took me a little while to get back off, and then the kids all get in with me from any time from about 5:30. So I can get them back off to sleep now with a little snuggle. So that's all right. But yeah,
how do you juggle having a job like EastEnders? Because I've got friends that have done soaps, not for as long as you though, not a stint as long as, because you were just saying before, you've been in it for about 14 months now.
Mm-hmm.
How do you juggle that with home life?
Well, you know, Wives are amazing, aren't
they? Yeah, I mean, I got a great one. Love having a wife. Highly recommend a wife, even to the gay men listening. Yeah. Get a wife. God, they're good.
They are good, and we make a really good team. Mm. And so essentially I get a schedule on the Thursday before the next week of right. the days I'm in.
Okay, from EastEnders, not from Ellie.
Not from Ellie. No, and Ellie. And we sit down on the couch and we plan the week. So we've got wraparound care in place. So all the kids are at school. So we've got after school clubs and we've got breakfast clubs. If I'm off, they don't go to some of those clubs and the breakfast club and have a shorter day. If I'm in, then Ellie has a really, really busy week in the sense of dropping them at 7:30, going and doing a full day at work and picking them up. So, but the thing about the EastEnders is that you pass the baton quite a lot. Your story pops up and you're full on and then it gets a little bit quieter. And so then I take the slack from Ellie and she works late. We basically just juggle it between us and we are a pretty awesome team, so
yeah that's impressive. And I only ever interview people that I like really want to chat to and that I want to do the research on. And so I was saying, we were coming down the stairs into the studio, I said, oh, I've been researching you this week, and you went, oh god. But it's pretty impressive when you like, I went to drama school and I was one of those actresses that didn't work, and you've been in the industry for a long time and working.
Now, isn't it? Yeah, 26 years.
For a long time.
Yeah, but there's been years where it's fallow.
Right.
Great friend of mine who wrote Waking the Dead, Barbara Machin, said within this industry, your career comes in waves.
Right.
And when a wave comes, ride that wave until it sort of drops off again. And so the reality for me is there have been like periods of a couple of years of no acting, and it's funny, you pop out of casting directors' minds or whoever's, you know, doing the productions, you're yesterday's news, as it were, and they've forgotten about you. And it's always that way, that once you're working again, everybody wants you to work with them again. So it's about finding a way to survive through those fallow periods, you know, and much more so now that I've got a family. It kind of didn't matter when it was me on my own. And there was a period in my life where I sent out a text to all of the friends that I knew had proper jobs and said, can I clean for you? Can I do any DIY for you? Can I come and paint your flat?
Yeah.
There has been those periods. I don't ever want to get back to that point because I've got children and a family to support. But I just think I've always been quite industrious. Also, my hobby is my job, so I don't mind doing it. I don't have any other hobbies. This morning, just before I've come to you, I've got this week off and I've just been on my music. I've just finished writing a song, and I was writing on Monday with Shelley Poole and a guy called Jeff Frenzel, who like played piano for Sinatra. The job at the moment is giving me, when I get these quieter times, is giving me the ability to feed that other addiction of mine, which is the music.
That's great. Yeah, because you popped up in This England.
I did, yeah.
Which I loved.
It was hardcore, wasn't it?
Really hardcore. I mean, for people that don't know, it's a Sky series.
It's Sky, and it's
about the first few months of the coronavirus.
Lockdown, yeah.
But at number 10, so with Boris and Carrie, and played Dominic Cummings' wife.
I did. Mary Wakefield, who's actually the editor of The Spectator.
Yes, so a woman in herself as well. Sure. Absolutely.
It was tricky, though, because obviously I have my political opinions on that whole period of time, but insofar as I watched quite a few videos of Mary Wakefield and doing interviews for The Spectator. And my role within the show ultimately is a mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really feel that I could put any spin on that. That wouldn't be okay. So I just kind of did a posh accent and hopefully took a bit from the videos that I watched and played her as a mother without any kind of...
Yeah.
How would she be as a mother? Because I didn't think that was fair. Because you never saw her at work. Yeah. You never saw her being political or whatever. So it was quite tricky, actually, to think, what am I going to do with this?
Is it the first time you've played a real person?
Do
you know what I mean? Yes. Like a person that exists in the world.
I've done historical stuff in theatre, like Moll Flanders. Was that a real person or was that a book? God, that shows how much my research had it. I was very young.
Sure.
No, I don't. Yeah, it is the first time. It's the first time. Mm. Yeah. I don't really like it, actually.
No. Okay, that's interesting. No.
Have you been watching The Crown?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think of the latest series?
I really prefer the Claire Foy series, mainly because I like how historical. I like that. And I feel like the first series was very exciting because you're like, oh, we're in Buckingham Palace. I wonder what that would look like.
And
oh,
she
I wonder
was, what she was amazing.
And she was amazing in it. And I loved Vanessa Kirby, who plays her sister. Is that her name?
Yeah.
Yeah. And who plays Margaret. And so there was. I thought I'm enjoying it, but I prefer it when it's further back in history.
I do have to say the actress who plays Diana. It's quite, when we're talking about playing real people, initially I felt like it felt slightly caricatured at the beginning, the demureness and the kind of...
and the looking
sort of
down
and
looking up.
But as it's gone on, I think, I don't know what episode we're on now, it's quite phenomenal.
Yeah, she's really got her.
Yeah.
It's really...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
But yeah, the pressure of that is quite
yeah, especially
tricky. I mean,
playing
him
someone.
As Boris Johnson, Kenneth Branagh as Boris.
Yeah.
I think within the first 10 minutes, at first you're going, oh my gosh,
yeah.
Kenneth Branagh as Boris Johnson. And then after 10 minutes, you kind of forget.
Yeah.
And I think this England was, Michael Winterbottom directed it. I mean, really, he was, other than Kenneth, was kind of the star of the show, as it were. And he wanted to put together a almost like a docudrama. So unlike The Crown, which some could say is salacious or...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's definitely a dramatisation.
Yeah, he wanted to base it purely on facts, which in some realms might mean that maybe Boris comes off looking better than he actually was. I don't know, but I did respect the fact that Michael took that and...
Yeah.
Just wanted to present it as a factual.
I wonder if he quotes Shakespeare as much, because fucking hell, he was annoying. It's like, oh,
I know,
God,
but
he's tedious.
Like, literally, us carries in bed and stuff.
Yeah.
It's just like, how did you go there?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Anyway, enough of Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Quite often, with this podcast, we sort of go chronologically.
Okay.
So, you grew up in Bradford.
I did, yeah.
And you were very musical from quite a young age.
Yeah, I played piano from 7 and I was a cantor in the church.
Yes.
So like standing at the front at the pulpit.
And that's Catholic.
It's a Catholic
church,
thing.
Yeah,
Catholic church, singing the hallelujahs and singing the psalms. So I'd learn them each week and sing. I mean, basically it was so it made mass entertaining.
Yeah.
Sure. Because I would sit in the church and want to scream. We've talked about our self-diagnosed adult ADHD, but it meant that every Sunday there was something to do.
Yeah, be busy.
Yeah, keep busy, exactly.
So you were always sort of theatrical, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I don't think I wasn't precocious and I wasn't... I went to a council-run drama group called the Bradford Youth Players, and everybody was volunteers, and so we were a real sort of motley group of kids, really. So it wasn't polished. I wasn't a kind of polished kid. It was a bit rawer than that. Although when I did get to the point of auditioning for drama school, I was sort of told to lose all of that kind of... I came from musical theatre, really, as a kid. That's what you do as a kid.
Absolutely, yeah, me too.
You know, yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, Half a Sixpence, and Andy Egan, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Keep smiling, then they won't look at your feet, you know.
Oh, 100%.
I was never a dancer, so... I always just did it, and I could sing. And I probably think I haven't actually improved as a singer since I was about 13. And I do remember a sort of swirl around me of adults being like, oh my goodness. And my mum's got a recording somewhere. But I didn't actually really get any better from there on in. But as a 13-year-old, I think it was quite like, oh, okay, I think she can
do it. And so was it always sort of, did you know that you wanted to go into the industry, for want of a better word?
I just literally couldn't think of anything else. I couldn't wait to leave school. I couldn't wait to try out and get to drama school. And normally with drama school, you don't go till quite a bit after your A-levels.
Yep.
They like you to have a bit of life experience.
Yeah.
So I was the youngest in my year. There was only me and maybe two others in my year that had come straight from school. So I was super young and super green. My only regret is I never did that kind of traveling around the world thing. I just couldn't wait to get started. I just, another year's delay on getting going was just not on my remit at all.
Do you know what? That is exactly the same as me. Yeah. I remember getting prospectuses from drama schools from when I was about 15.
Yeah.
And like seeing like, and looking at all those black and white pictures they put in of like someone playing Ophelia. But yeah. I just want to be there
just
and
wanna
I want to make
it. I used to get the stage newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
And so at the back, they used to have open auditions for the chorus in a lot of the big musicals.
Yeah.
And I think the moment my parents stopped doubting me was the only day, I was quite a good girl at school, the only day I bunked off school. There was an open audition for Les Mis in Manchester. I'd never got a train from Bradford to Manchester on my own in my life. I think I was 13 or 14. And I went and I sat in a room with a lot of grown-ups waiting to go in an audition and walked out. They had the auditions on the Palace stage. And I walked out onto the Palace stage with these, just remember these glaring spotlights in my face and a table in the auditorium,
like a chorus line
with four people sitting there. Yeah, like the real deal. And I sung a song, I can't remember what it was, and they just said, how old are you? And 14. They're like, it was really good, but you need to probably come back in about 4 years time. And I phoned my mum from Manchester Piccadilly and told her where I was, and from that moment on nobody questioned.
That's what you're going to do.
The careers officer stopped giving me other options, you know.
I love that. I love that. You said you were quite a good girl at school. Were you?
Yeah, I mean, I was good in the sense of I didn't bunk off. And I didn't. I mean, I was cheeky as anything, but.
And were you, did you have like a group of mates?
I'm not friends with any of them now. I think, not fallen out. I just think that it's really weird talking about this to you now because I'm sort of processing it at the same time. I think that I was just so single-minded in what I wanted to do that sort of connection with friends who didn't know what they wanted to do was difficult, maybe.
Yeah.
Because I didn't stay in touch with anyone. I did have a group of pals, but we didn't stay in touch. I just went to drama school and then I came out. So then that's a whole nother difference.
Yeah.
So I've got friends from the drama group that I was in and then from university.
Yeah.
And then from the gay scene.
Yeah, but that's the same for me in that I didn't. If someone said something like, "I don't like musical theatre," in my sort of 16-year-old brain, I'd be like, "How could I possibly be friends with you?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, how could I? If we can't talk about cabaret, then I don't think I can be friends with you. Like, I was so single-minded and obsessed.
I was obsessed.
What it was like to be. I remember going. My mum got me tickets to go and see Grease in the West End. And I must have been like 13.
Yeah.
And I wasn't super popular at school. And so me and mum went together and we went to the matinee and then mum went, do you want to go to stage door? And I didn't really know what stage door was, but I was like, yeah, okay. And we saw all of the girls who were the Pink Ladies.
Oh, wow.
And they were in Juicy Couture tracksuits.
They were expensive and cool.
Yeah, and they all had their hair. They had scarves around their head to keep their hair, and they had their makeup on because they had their evening show. And who knows what had happened, but they fell out the door laughing. Something had happened. Maybe something had gone wrong on the show. They were killing themselves laughing. And I looked at them and thought, that's your job. That's magic.
Yeah.
I would move heaven and earth.
To do that to be lucky enough to do that as a job. I still feel like that today. Literally, not one bit of me is tired of my work on any level, on the music or the acting. Like every time I get a job, every time people come to gigs, I'm thankful.
Yes.
Because I just can't believe I'm still doing it.
That's exactly how I feel about stand-up. I feel like, I know I've got mates that are comics that sort of, they sort of go, oh, if I never do stand-up again, I wouldn't care, or I don't really, you know, whatever. Or they do more and more telly, and then it's more about telly for them than about sort of, you know, more about presenting, say, than like the craft of writing stand-up.
So what's your thing? Is it like the actual live shows?
Live shows, I think. Yeah. I mean, I love doing telly, and I do bits and bobs, which is really nice, but there's something about the immediacy of like a live crowd, especially if it's a big crowd. If you go on stage, I did... the Royal Albert Hall earlier this year.
Wow.
Yeah. Just like a set on a mixed bill show.
Don't start bringing charity. It down. You did the Royal Albert Hall, just leave it there, right?
Yeah, and so that's like 6,000 and it was amazing.
Was it?
And I walked off stage and was like, I was kind of tearful because it was just like, oh, I was right to keep doing stand-up. I was right to not give up. I was right to carry on.
Yeah, but all your drama, all your acting training and everything else, very obviously,
it does inform
your set. Like, I see it. Like, you, absolutely.
This very much isn't about me, though, so let's get back to talking about you. No, I mean, I'm a stand-up. I can talk about me endlessly. But you mentioned coming out. And did you come out when you were 19?
It's kind of a tricky one. I was with a woman for the first time when I was 19, but ultimately I didn't say those words until she left.
Right.
And then you were sort of left with it all going, and now I don't know what the hell to do. So would I have been probably 21? I mean, everybody in my year knew I was with this woman that was in my year. So there was that sort of coming out in terms of everybody at Manchester Poly, where I was at drama school, knew. But actually coming out to my parents and everything else was after she left, which came as quite a shock. I wasn't
right.
It came out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And I was in my final year at drama school and I started to have what now I know is panic attacks. You think it's, if you've ever had one, like you think must be a heart attack. I couldn't.
Yeah.
And, an actress friend of mine, Liz Hume Dawson, I always name drop her because she sort of saved my life in a way. I didn't drive and she just said, we're just driving across the M62. She was from Bradford as well. We're going on the M62 and you're going home to tell your parents tonight, because she saw what state I was in, and I was going out and getting drunk on a night and then coming into rehearsals really hungover. I just didn't know what to do with myself. Mm. And it was the final show of the whole 3 years and unfairly, 50% of your degree was on this one show. Like, it was insane. Like, 3 years of work and it all came down to this. And I was single-handedly smashing it to bits. She drove me home and I think I must have already told my brother. It's all a bit fuzzy.
Yeah.
Because he was there. And then I came out to them and left my brother with it.
Oh, what? Like, I've done this. Bye-bye now.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. They were amazing, though. Do you know what my mum said to me? I knew something was wrong because you've spent, every time I've phoned you, you've spent 18 months talking about the weather. Do not talking about anything of any depth whatsoever. Because obviously, like, most of the depth that I had was that.
Because you mentioned that you were at Mass as a child. Was it sort of a Catholic household that you grew up in?
Yeah.
So did you go to church every week?
Yeah, I was even going when I went to Manchester. I couldn't get it out of my system.
Really? How did that?
It didn't. That was why I left. I mean, I it's different when you've got your community church in Bradford where you sung and you knew everyone, mm-hmm. and mum and dad would have a glass of wine after midnight mass. You know, that was on Christmas, and my brother was an altar boy and all of that. It was a huge part of my life. Catholic education, all girls school for the last, from about 13 to 18. And we used to go to church before school. Like, it wasn't just on a Sunday.
Wow.
Like, there'd be short services in mornings of school. It was so, like, I am going to say, it is like an indoctrination, really. I mean, it's not, because people out there believe and I respect people's beliefs and religions, but for me it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. When I came out, I'd started going to a church in Manchester, but obviously I didn't know anyone, so I'd just sit at the back.
Yeah.
And then I was sleeping with a woman, you know, and you're like, it wasn't sitting right. And then after I came out, I stopped going. But Sundays were, I literally was at a loss, because we'd do church and then we'd go to my grandparents for, so basically I didn't have a Sunday. It was church and then my grandma's for Sunday dinner. I didn't know what to do. There was this day at the weekend where you're like, until I got a jazz residency.
Really?
A Sunday afternoon jazz residency, and it was the only thing that sort of filled a massive void in my life on a weekend. Yeah, it was weird.
And when I realised I was gay. It was when I was just before I got into drama school. I sort of decided in my head, I thought, I can't be gay and be an actress.
Oh, yeah.
I can't be out because I won't work. Did you have any of that?
Yeah, I was explicitly told.
Really? At drama school?
No, not at drama school. On a production.
Actual work?
Yeah, not to come out, yeah. I must never talk about it in the press.
I was told by someone at drama school, by one of the teachers, you should say you're bisexual because at the very least they'll be able to believe that you're a man.
It's weird.
How old would you have been when someone said...
I can actually probably say now. The producer who said it to me actually ended up getting sacked anyway for other bigoted comments. Yeah, it was on Ultimate Force. And I arrived on my first day and there was only really two other women, two or three, who were the makeup artists. Most, it was, you know, I sort of was the only girl in a boy's world for a lot of years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Always so doing tough jobs.
Yeah, I was fire brigade into the SAS.
Yeah.
But so I would have been like 29. So I hadn't spoken about it at all through London's Burning. I just didn't do any press. I just didn't really do
anything.
And were
you in relationships then?
Yeah.
And London's Burning was massive.
Yeah, it really was, yeah.
So did you have to be careful?
I probably wasn't. I don't think anyone was really that interested in
right.
me.
Right. Did you ever worry about, like, the press being, like, if you were out for dinner or would you...
Do you know what? I can't really remember. I think maybe they knew, maybe they did know, but all I know is that on The Ultimate Force, arriving there and being told you mustn't, he said to me, the main guy... We arrive at the hotel, everybody's there, you're really nervous. Day one of filming is the next day. And he just says, now Heather, there's the two makeup artists there who are women. And in front of them, he said, now Heather, we all know you're a lesbian. He said, but if you can just know that you're here as the male totty, so we won't be talking about that. And he left, right? And I turned to the makeup artists, who are my only female allies, you know, and at that time, you don't know how people are going to react.
Yeah.
And I just said, I'm a lesbian, and by the way, my name's Heather. Pleased to meet you, you know. But luckily, obviously, they were amazing and it was fine. But yeah, sort of been told so explicitly that that mustn't come out. They nearly outed me on London's Burning. I got called into, it was LWT at the time, on a Saturday night. They call you in and you go to the 22nd floor.
What, is this like a press thing?
Yeah, that they're going to out you in the Sunday papers.
Wait, how were you like, I can't remember? And then you're like, oh, no, wait a minute, I was almost outed by the paper.
Yeah, no, but they didn't, for whatever reason, some other story broke and they didn't run it.
What would that have been like the, what was it called? The 3 a.m. girls? Or
I don't know. No, it was like a splat, like an article.
Oh, like an article.
But back in the day, they'd make it salacious. So what they're doing is they offer you, they say you're able to comment and tell your story. But if you don't tell your story, we're just going to print it anyway. And then obviously if you don't have any input into that, you can't sort of control, they can
the
make
narrative,
it sound salacious or... But they didn't out me in the end. Goodness knows why.
So did you sit down with them and have a chat?
No, I said, no, I'm not going to comment. Do your worst. Do whatever you want to do. No, I didn't. I think, and at that time my grandparents were still alive. So beyond that, it didn't really matter. I wouldn't care what came out now. But
sure.
My Catholic grandparents were still alive, and it just wouldn't have been good.
Right. So you're on Ultimate Force, so you're not allowed to come out.
I know, dressed in all my army gear, running around on a motorbike. It's like I think they've seen it.
I think this is the girl with the
short,
I've ever had.
Short hair in the SAS who's on the motorbike. Apparently she's straight.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be more of a shock. And so how long after that? Because then the thing that I first became aware of you of course, was lip service.
Yeah.
Because of, there's a bit little age gap between us. And so lip service was sort of, post the L word, it was really big on my radar.
Yeah, it was.
That I was, I think I was still in drama school or just left drama school. And it was the sort of thing where I was like, oh my God, amazing.
Yeah.
And then I remember being really disappointed to find out there was only one actual lesbian there. But was that then?
That's when I came out.
Did you? Right, okay, because I didn't know whether you'd come out and then it was
that's when I came out.
So you got cast in it before. Yeah. They were like, wait a minute, we need a woman that looks like she could be gay and she's going to be a detective. Have you watched the SAS show?
There's actually, there's something, I haven't seen it for years, so I might be saying this wrong, but there was is it on the DVD extras or something? I don't know. There's a film where basically I'm talking about filming the show and I'm blatantly not out yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it might be on the DVD extras. But I kind of knew I would have to, and it was my responsibility to. I think that whole Ultimate Force thing must have just scared me a bit.
Because did you think, like I did, that if I come out, and if it's, people can assume, but if it's a yes, I am, that it would sort of mean work would dry up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, the reality is that I've pretty much only played gay since then.
Yeah.
Apart from when directors literally have no idea who you are, which was the Mary Wakefield. And I did another thing called Prey with John Sims, Sim playing his wife. But other than that, I pretty much have just played gay, which I love because I do give it an authenticity and a swagger and all other things. But it is proof in point that people perhaps can't see beyond it.
Yeah.
But I'm cool with that as well. I'm actually really cool with that. Not people not being able to see beyond it, but what I'm doing at the moment and everything else. You know, when you do get the odd like Twitter comment, oh, she only plays lesbians, and it's like, well, yeah, because I have to work and that's the jobs that I'm given now. For the first 15 years. You know
but
what
no
I mean?
One would. But also, no one would ever be like, "Oh, that straight girl only plays straight roles." When is she going to play gay?
Exactly. There was my favourite Twitter comment was this dude the other week, and so I'm obviously playing opposite a woman in EastEnders at the moment, Balvinda, who plays Suki, and he said, "Oh, I hate her. All she ever does is promote lesbianism, right?" And
in fairness, you do that.
But you know what I wanted to say was, if you think I promote lesbianism, that means you've really, really enjoyed that, because it's obviously like looks that good that the girls are all going, that's what I want to do.
That's what I'm into.
That's what I want to get. I want a wife, not a husband.
Yeah, I thought I wanted to be an accountant, but actually I want to be a lesbian now that I've watched this.
Yeah, it's like you've just literally sort of blowing yourself up by saying you promote lesbianism, meaning you do it really well.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you're promoting it. I get it. And is it? I read an article where you were saying that you spoke to the BBC bosses or the EastEnders bosses, and you said, "I'm up for doing this as long as you don't kill Eve."
Yeah, it sort of got blown out of proportion in the sense of it's certainly not contractually binding.
You made a suggestion.
I made a suggestion. What I did was bring up the tropes.
Yeah,
which
sure.
Which is they're either psychos or they die.
Yes.
And I just pointed this out to the producers who weren't aware of the tropes.
They weren't.
Why would they be? Because we look into it, you know. And so they're like, is that really a thing? I'm like, yeah, there's literal actual articles written on it if you want to just have a look. It's absolutely fine if there's no more stories for the character, if you don't want me here anymore. But
if I leave in a car,
I'm just
fine.
Asking, I'm just asking if it's possible not to kill her. And you know, verbally they've said, oh, absolutely, if this really is a thing, then, you know, it's absolutely on their radar. So
it really is. And it feels like it's so infrequent that we get a story that isn't bleak. We've spoken about this on the podcast before, but like, you know, you just end up sort of going, God, what is it this time? Is it going to be the AIDS crisis, or is it going to be gay bashing, or is it going to be she loses her mind, or is it going to be that she kills herself, or when is it going to be? I mean, it can be a breakup. It can be sad.
Yeah, because I was going to say the thing about soap, unlike film, we can't always have a happy ending.
Because
if they just have a happy ending, then that's just then. well, unless they go off together into the sunset because both of us want to leave and, you know, and it just suits it, that would be perfect, which is actually what I did in Waterloo Road. Mm-hmm. And I fought for that as well, the ending of that with the girl in that. I said, can they not just go off into the sunset together? And that's exactly what happened. So, yeah, just trying to bring in those changes. I mean, the relationship that we're building up at the moment in EastEnders, it's just the longevity of it, of women of a certain age who support each other. It's a great partnership.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying it at the moment.
That's great. So back to lip service and coming out. Once you had taken that role and you'd shot some of it, did you sort of go, oh, I'm going to have to do this in sort of a public way? I'm going to have to sort of...
What happened?
Did you do like a diva cover or a diva interview?
That wasn't until it had gone out. That's all a bit fuzzy as well. I can't remember. They must have just asked.
And you just
said
yes. In articles,
I guess. It would have been in the normal press rounds, probably.
I mean, I don't know what your experience of being on lip service was like, but was it a very sort of straight production? Was there elements where you were like, that doesn't seem real, or that doesn't, or was it written by a gay woman?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, right. Okay. Harriet Brown.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Because that makes all the difference. Because sometimes you do watch things and go, it does just seem like they're housemates.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's just like an.
I think we spent a lot of time on the intimate stuff to get it right. Like the whole premise of it was the kind of opposite of the pornographic images of lesbianism, and they always said it would be beautifully lit. You know, it would be love stories. It would be, and I think they stayed true to that. And unlike when we do the intimate scenes on EastEnders, because we don't have the time, and it's not everything.
Yes, it isn't
everything. It was also a big part of lip service.
Yeah.
The intimate stuff was a big part of it.
With soap, regardless of gender or sexuality, there's only so intimate you can really be.
Yeah, no,
be
exactly.
At
you
like
can't get
7,
to,
7:30.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like it's going to get particularly steamy.
No. Lip service was pretty full on.
Did your parents watch it? Do you ever worry about that sort of thing?
Oh, they did. It's the only show they've not really said a lot about.
Right, yeah.
We just don't talk about it. They, you know, and I never pushed them for their opinion of the show. So, they.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, especially, you know, if they're... I mean, I don't know what their sort of religious journeys are now, but I suppose also if, you know, they've been part of the Catholic Church in a big way as well.
It would have been anything to do with Catholicism. It's just, you know, my parents only had sex twice, just once for me and once for my brother.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I just don't need to know.
Of course.
And they don't need to know. And that's the end of it.
And I think because
it's absolutely not that. And coming back to my mum, actually, only a few years ago after me and Ellie had our civil partnership and then we got married, she announced to me that she was no longer going to a Catholic church. Because they didn't accept her daughter and her daughter-in-law. So she now goes to Church of England. Do they? I don't know.
They
do, don't they?
Well, we had the Reverend Richard Coles on the show, and he's an out priest.
Right, okay. Well, there you go. So that was a big deal for my mum.
Yeah.
Like, late in life to go, do you know what? No. Nope.
That's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's really nice.
It was a teary moment. I've got you off your roll now.
No, not at all. It's just little bits. Just little bits I think would be interesting to talk about. What were you saying beforehand? Oh, you were saying about sex scenes. Yeah. I mean, I think as well, because like if you've got to do a straight sex scene, it is just sort of like you can just sort of, you know, everybody sort of goes, oh, okay, yeah, you just sort of can do that. But I think with gay women, because there's always that thing of going, well, what do they do? Yeah. You're going, oh, no, wait a minute, how deep are we getting into them? I mean,
God. Where do you want to go with this?
Yeah, it's quite, you don't need to have those conversations. I think
there's
you're right
a lot,
to
it's
not
a
have
lot.
Those conversations with
no,
your mum.
But we did have to have those conversations. But we did, as yeah, actors,
on set,
we did
yeah.
have to have those conversations.
Well, of course, yeah. I've had those conversations with straight actresses where I've been like, right, okay, so what we're going to do, you're going to have to sort of lay a bit like this. I'm the expert here. And but it's important also, I think, for that authenticity, because I think, like, I mean, I imagine that you've still got a massive audience from lip service that
yeah,
sort
I think
of...
that's where a lot of people found the music. It was really weird because there was a massive break between the first and second series, and then obviously, as we know, they never recommissioned again. And so between that filming that first series and it going out, I'd put on loads of little shows, like 50-seater gigs. I'd got on the road because I was broke.
Yeah.
And suddenly they just sold out. Like it just started, selling out. So I was like, what is happening? There was one guy at the guitar bar in Nottingham. He threw his mobile phone in the river because he didn't even have like a ticket booking service thing. You just had to phone the venue, and he admitted he threw his phone in the river.
Oh my God, that's hilarious!
Because he was the most chilled guy. He's like, what's happened to my life? I don't want this anymore. You know, so it all went a bit mad. But ultimately, it's now the music fans that are left. There was a lot of people who came to see the shows because I'd been naked on TV or whatever reason.
But they'd found
and that's dropped
you.
Off. Yeah, they found it through that and perhaps weren't into the music, whereas now I've got a nice, solid
because you're about to go back on the road.
Why am I stammering so much today? Have I had too much caffeine?
You were up at 3 o'clock. Yeah. That's what it is. You're up at 3 o'clock and you've got three kids.
And
you're in a soap. That's what it is, mate. You need sleep.
Yeah. I've just put out two shows, 4th and 5th of February next year, just London and Brighton. It's all I can do.
Yeah.
It's all I can do. But I don't want that to dip away, you know, and I'm writing again. So
Especially when you've sort of always had that. You were saying, you know, right at the top, that like you know, that's your two passions.
Yeah,
you've got to like keep them both cooking.
You should come and open for me, Susie.
I'd love to. Be a pleasure.
Only if you'll let me come and open for you.
Absolutely, no worries. I'm not sure how much music fans want comedy, but I'll try it.
Do they not?
I don't know.
Does it not work? I always think back to old style cabaret. You know.
Yeah, I mean, we could do that. I'll dress up as Liza Minnelli if you want.
I don't want to throw it. No, you'd make a really good Liza Minnelli.
Well, I mean, only when my hair's like this.
You absolutely would.
Yeah.
Well, that's bang on point.
Maybe one day. And so after you came out, I mean, you're sort of very vocal.
Generally.
In the same way. Well, yeah, right. She says into a microphone.
Yeah.
You're very vocal, says Chatty Cathy over here.
Yeah, Chatty Cathy, that's what my friend calls Jessie. My friend Bliss Jessie Chatty Cathy.
She doesn't stop talking.
Yeah, but what was that from?
Chatty Cathy, I think, and Tom Allen told me this, so if it's wrong, blame him. Chatty Cathy was a doll that you pulled a string out the back and she'd go...
Chatty Cathy.
And so I refer to myself as a Chatty Cathy.
Well, I'm going to Google it as soon as we get out of the studio.
I don't stop chatting.
Chatty Cathy, I love it. That's my Jessie as well.
But once you were out, did it then feel like something that you were like, oh, well, I haven't spoken about this, so now I want to be outspoken?
It wasn't a case of being outspoken. It's just that quite a few people approach you.
Right.
About, you know, will you do... There was a video of It Gets Better campaign, so I did that. I just opened myself up to whatever anybody wanted me to do or be vocal about. It wasn't a conscious decision on my part. It was just where I could help, I would help.
Yeah.
That's all that happened with that, really. Because they always say LGBT activists, and I'm just like, I was led.
Yeah.
In a good way.
No, but it's the same with me. People have said before to me that, oh, well, you're sort of an activist, and you sort of go, well...
It's all those other people that put us up to it that are the activists.
Yeah, the people
done
that are
the hard work.
Yeah,
and
then I just
then
sort of like fanny
up
in.
And chatty Cathy it.
Exactly. I fanny in, tell a few jokes,
exactly.
Wear a suit.
Yeah.
What more do you want?
Exactly.
Like, slick my hair
bit
back.
Of swagger.
Oh,
all
too much.
Of the swagger.
Too much.
Yeah,
bit.
I noticed that. Your swagger's good,
man. The last question I always ask is sort of a. We get lots of people that listen to the show. We have loads of allies. We have loads of young people, people that are at the beginning of their coming out journey, people that have been out for years, and people that just want to be better friends or parents or, you know, whoever. They just want to listen to the show and learn a little bit more about people like us. I always ask for sort of a message. It can be a message to, like, I'm thinking of the version of Heather that was being driven from Manchester to Bradford by your friend that had sort of... all that fear and all those butterflies. If you could reach out to her, or indeed someone that is listening right now to this podcast that is at that beginning of their journey, if you could reach out to them and give them a few words of encouragement or a bit of advice, what would you say?
It's always the same thing. Find someone that you tell first, that you know will be okay, that probably already knew, one of your best pals, mm-hmm. that you have in place to come back and have the debrief after you've gone to the parents and the family and everything that's worrying you. Mm-hmm. I mean, brilliant if you've got more than one. But hopefully people have one person that mm-hmm. they can do that with. But that would definitely be my advice in terms of, yeah, of just having the debrief and having a person to talk to once it's done, once the deed is done.
Yeah, maybe a glass of wine.
Yeah, you could have a glass of wine as well.
Heather, thank you so much for talking to me. This was brilliant.
Yeah, no worries. It's been lovely. Thanks for asking me.
Oh, I loved that conversation. I just think she's absolutely brilliant. I hope you enjoyed it too. Please, please get in touch. The email is hello@susieruffle.com. And I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Okay, bye.